Welcome to the HN Pod. We're your daily guide through the Hacker News front page.
Yep, bringing you the context behind the clicks.
Today is Monday, May 12th, 2025, and this is episode number 32.
And our mission, as always, is to dive into those interesting stories grabbing attention in the HN community.
Give you the key takeaways, the context, you know, the stuff that matters.
Exactly. And today's a really good mix. We've got app security, some AI stuff, urban planning, even fusion energy.
Shows the range, doesn't it? That typical Hacker News curiosity.
It really does. From our daily apps to, well, the future of the planet.
Okay, let's jump in. First up, an article in the title that grabs you. I hacked a dating app and how not to treat a security researcher.
Ah, yes, this one. It's definitely a bit of a cautionary tale.
Sounds like it. What's the core story here?
So basically, a security researcher found some pretty serious vulnerabilities in a dating app called Circa. Like, really significant flaws.
Okay, significant how? What kind of things are we talking about?
Well, first, a broken OTP implementation. One-time passwords, right?
Right, the codes you get texted.
Exactly. Theirs was flawed, meaning someone could potentially just take over another user's account.
Yikes. That's bad enough on its own.
But it gets worse. Mm-hmm. They also found unprotected API endpoints, just open pathways, leaking sensitive user data.
Okay, define sensitive. What kind of data?
A lot. Yeah. We're talking first and last names, obviously, gender, who you're interested in, your city, even down to latitude and longitude.
Whoa, precise location. That's not good.
Not at all. Then there's university email, verification status, industry, profession, date of birth, age, height.
Just keeps going.
Oh, yeah. University ID and name, how complete your profile is, national ID verification status.
National ID, like passport.
That has a verification, yeah.
Yeah.
And mobile and email verification status, premium status and expiry, activity status, profile type, mobile number, email address.
This is basically everything you'd put into a dating app.
Pretty much. User type, user ID, profile images, university details, match preferences. Those user prompts are icebreakers.
The little questions you answer, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mutual contact previews and count, creation and update timestamps, Zodiac info, distance to other users, even some internal final score.
That's an incredible amount of personal information just exposed.
It is. And here's the kicker. That national ID info. The researcher found they could potentially access the document number and even URLs for the front, back, and selfie photos provided for verification.
Seriously, how?
Now, to be fair, you need to be logged in as any user to get that specific ID data.
Yeah.
But given the broken OTP,
it isn't necessarily a huge barrier.
Right. The researcher found data on over 6,000 users. About 200 of those had the ID info exposed, and interestingly, 19 users claimed to be Yale students.
Wow. So what happened when the researcher tried to tell Circa?
Well, that's the second part of the title, right?
Yeah.
How not to treat a security researcher. They tried contacting Circa twice in early March, March 5th and 13th. Crickets. As of late April, when the article was published, they hadn't received any real response.
Despite finding all these serious flaws, that's not great.
It's not great at all. The good news is, the article does note the vulnerabilities have since been patched. So current users should be okay now.
Okay, that's something. But the initial handling.
Yeah, it raises questions. The implications of this kind of data exposure are huge.
Okay.
Privacy invasion is obvious, but think about identity theft, stalking, blackmail.
Absolutely terrifying possibilities.
It really underscores why companies, especially those handling sensitive data, need to prioritize security and have a clear process for responding to researchers.
This whole thing apparently sparked a debate on Hacker News, too, about licensing for software engineers. Like, should they be regulated like civil engineers?
Yeah, that's a perennial debate. The argument is, you know, software runs so much of our critical infrastructure now, maybe there should be some professional standards, some license to ensure basic competence, especially around security.
Makes sense on one level, but the counter arguments.
Well, the big ones are that it could stifle innovation in a field that moves incredibly fast. And how do you even define the standards realistically? What would the test cover? Would it actually prevent these kinds of issues?
Plus, even licensed professionals make mistakes, right?
Exactly. It's a tough one. And it also ties into the ethics for the researchers themselves.
How so?
Like, how much data do you access to prove a point? Where's the line between responsible disclosure and, you know, potentially breaking the law or violating privacy yourself, even with good intentions? This researcher seemed careful, but it highlights that tension.
Definitely a lot to unpack there. Okay, let's shift gears from app security to embeddings. The next article is Embeddings Are Underrated, 2024. What exactly are we talking about here?
Okay, so embeddings, in the context of machine learning, are basically numerical representations of things like text or images or audio. Think of them as coordinates in a high-dimensional space.
Coordinates, like on a map.
Sort of, yeah. But a map of meaning. The key idea is that things with similar meanings, words, sentences, whole documents, get mapped to points that are close together in this embedding space.
Yeah.
It lets computers grasp semantic relationships.
So it turns meaning into math, essentially.
That's a great way to put it. And the article highlights that this isn't just theoretical anymore. Services like Google's Gemini or Voyage AI make it really accessible. The author even includes a little code snippet showing how easy it is to get an embedding for Hello World using Gemini.
And the output is just a long list of numbers.
Exactly. An array of numbers. The article mentions Gemini uses 768 dimensions, Voyage AI uses 1 in 24. And importantly, these aren't interchangeable. Each provider's model creates its own unique map.
Right. And what about the cost? Generating these sounds intensive.
The initial training of these models is very intensive, yes. Huge data sets, lots of computation. But using a pre-trained model to generate an embedding for a new piece of text is actually relatively cheap and fast.
Okay, but why are they underrated, specifically for technical writing, which seems to be the article's focus?
This is where it gets interesting for documentation teams. The author argues embeddings are a superpower for technical writers. Imagine you have thousands of pages of documentation. How do you find related concepts?
Search, I guess. Keywords.
Right, but keywords only get you so far. What if related articles use different terminology? Embeddings let you find documents that are semantically similar, even if they don't share exact words. It helps you discover connections at scale.
Ah, so it improves discoveriness, as the author puts it, making it easier for users to find what they need, even if they don't know the right jargon.
Precisely. The author thinks it can help tackle big challenges in tech writing, like ensuring consistency, finding related content, maybe even identifying gaps. They even built a Sphinx extension to generate embeddings for documentation projects.
That sounds genuinely useful. There was some discussion on HN comparing embeddings to fuzzy hashes. Is that accurate?
Not really. It's an understandable analogy at first glance, but they're fundamentally different. Hashes, even fuzzy ones, are designed for uniqueness and integrity checking. They destroy semantic meaning to create a fingerprint. Embeddings do the opposite. They aim to capture semantic meaning in that high-dimensional space.
Got it. Meaning versus uniqueness. What about semantic algebra? That sounds cool. Like king man plus woman equals queen.
Yeah, that's one of the classic, almost mind-blowing examples suggesting these embeddings capture deeper relationships between concepts. The extent to which they capture all nuances, like text length someone asked about on HN, is still an area of research, but the core semantic similarity is powerful.
Are there good open source options? The article mentioned the big commercial ones.
Absolutely. That was a key point in the HN comments. There are fantastic open-source embedding models you can run yourself, sometimes even outperforming the commercial ones on specific benchmarks. The MTEB leaderboard was mentioned. Models like Nomex, BGE, GTE, AllMinl, LML6V2. Lots of great options.
Good to know. It's not just locked behind big tech paywalls. The article also briefly mentioned inference time intervention.
Yeah, that's more cutting-edge research, the idea of manipulating the embedding vectors after they're generated to maybe tweak the meaning or style of the text they represent. Shows the field is still evolving fast.
So the takeaway is embeddings are a powerful, accessible tool for understanding meaning in text and finding connections, especially useful for organizing large amounts of information like documentation.
Exactly. Ethical, efficient, and focused on semantic similarity. Underrated, perhaps.
Okay, from digital meaning maps to concrete architecture, let's head to London. Next up, The Barbican, an article and photo essay. What exactly is The Barbican?
The Barbican is this huge, iconic complex in London, mostly residential, but also a major arts center. Built between the mid-60s and mid-70s, it's probably the prime example of brutalist architecture in the UK, maybe the world.
Brutalist, right. Lots of concrete. And the article says it's designed as a kind of self-contained world.
Very much so. The idea was you could have everything you need right there. Flats, shops, arts venues, gardens, a city within a city. And it's famously maze-like.
Intentionally confusing.
Apparently so. Adds to the character. There's stories about its disorienting walkways. It also has this massive underground garage, supposedly with some abandoned vintage cars tucked away.
Adds to the mystique. And the buildings have names.
Yeah. Named after figures from English history, Shakespeare Tower, Cromwell Tower, and so on. The architecture itself draws inspiration from unexpected places, like ancient Egypt, with this recurring rounded rectangle motif called a cartouche.
Interesting. And the site itself has history.
Oh, yeah. It's built on an area heavily bombed in WWII, but before that, it was part of Roman Londonium. There are even remnants of the old Roman wall, and believe it or not, a 1,000-year-old Jewish burial ground within the estate boundaries.
Wow, layers upon layers. What about living there? Any quirks mentioned?
Well, there's the famous central heating system, apparently. Residents don't have individual control over it.
I can imagine the debates.
For sure. But it seems to foster a strong community. They have an active online forum, barbicantalk.com. The architecture also references designers like Le Corbusier, and it's become a super popular spot for filming, photo shoots. Architects love it.
And it's a big arts hub too, right?
Huge. Home to a branch of the Guildhall School of Music and Drama, some building elements even look like tuning forks. Plus a cinema, the Barbican Theater and Concert Hall Complex, and the amazing Barbican Conservatory.
The conservatory, that giant indoor tropical garden.
That's the one. An incredible green space right in the heart of it all. And despite feeling like its own world, it's actually really well connected now, especially with the Elizabeth Line station nearby.
Sounds fascinating. The article mentioned books about it, too, for people who want more detail.
Yeah.
What did the Hacker News crowd add?
Some neat comparisons. Someone likened it to BBC Radio 3, suggesting it attracts a certain kind of resident, maybe? A curated neighborhood vibe.
Huh, interesting analogy.
Yeah. And comparisons to other unique housing projects, like Habitat 67 in Montreal, or the Interlace in Singapore. Contextualizing it globally.
Any other tidbits?
A fun fact. The huge fly tower needed for the theater stage is apparently hidden away underneath the conservatory structure.
Clever.
And inevitably, someone compared its look to the Citadel from the Mass Effect games.
I can see that. The scale, the structure.
Exactly. And just general appreciation for the boldness of the Daedalus style, its three-dimensional quality, is definitely a place that sparks opinions.
Okay, next, just a quick mention that popped up on the front page. A community-led fork of Organic Maps.
Right. Not a lot of detail in our sources on this one, but Organic Maps is a popular open-source, privacy-focused mapping app based on OpenStreetMap data.
So a fork suggests some disagreement or a desire for a different direction.
Potentially. Or maybe just a group wanting to accelerate development on specific features. Either way, seeing community activity around open source mapping alternatives is generally a positive sign. Something to keep an eye on.
Definitely. Okay, finally, let's tackle something really ambitious. University of Texas-led team solves a big problem for fusion energy. This sounds big.
It could be quite significant, yeah. This is about a team from UT Austin, Los Alamos National Lab, and a company called Type 1 Energy Group. They claim to have cracked a long-standing problem in fusion energy research.
Specifically for which type of fusion?
This relates to stellarators, which are an alternative design to the more common tokamak reactors. The problem was accurately predicting the behavior of alpha particles within the stellarator's complex magnetic fields.
Alpha particles? Those are the helium nuclei produced by the fusion reaction itself, right?
Exactly. And containing them properly is crucial for the reactor to sustain the fusion process and generate energy efficiently. But predicting their paths is incredibly complex.
Why is it so hard?
Well, simulating it directly using Newton's laws just takes way too much computing power.
Yeah.
It's impractical. And the existing approximation methods, often based on something called perturbation theory, just weren't accurate enough for the complex, twisty magnetic fields inside a stellarator.
So what's the breakthrough? How do they solve it?
They developed a completely new method based on symmetry theory. It allows them to make much more accurate predictions. And they say it's about 10 times faster than trying to do those direct brute force simulations.
10 times faster and more accurate. That sounds like a win-win.
It does. One of the researchers, Dr. Burby, was quoted saying that before their work, there was basically no practical way to theoretically answer the alpha particle confinement question for stellarators.
That really puts it into perspective. Their work is published.
Yes, the findings are out, and someone on Hacker News helpfully linked the RCIF paper, so the details are available for scrutiny.
And you can bet the HN discussion got technical.
Oh, absolutely. Clarifications that wasn't just curve-fitting data, but learning a specific mathematical model. A non-perturbative guiding center model informed by simulation data. Lots of talk about the immense challenges of magnetoplasma hydrodynamics.
Keeping that super hot plasma contained.
Precisely. And how incredibly sensitive these systems are. There was also some debate, as you might expect, comparing the pros and cons of Stellarators versus tokamaks in controlling different kinds of plasma instabilities.
What about the data-driven label? I saw some comments questioning that.
Yeah, some people reacted to data-driven being paired with non-perturbative, which sounds contradictory. But digging into the paper, it seems it's a formal mathematical solution where a specific conserved quantity needs to be learned from simulation data to make the model work accurately. So, theory guided by data.
Makes sense. Did the discussion broaden out beyond the physics?
Of course. The usual very important questions about fusion's overall viability came up. Is it practical? When will it be economical compared to solar, wind, or even advanced fission? What about the engineering challenges, like neutron embrittlement of materials or radioactive waste handling?
Still big hurdles, even if the plasma physics gets solved.
Absolutely. And the role of government funding versus private ventures like Type 1 Energy or Helium Fusion, which also got mentioned with a dose of the usual skepticism about their claims. Even a side debate on whether storing current nuclear fission waste is truly a solved problem.
And I saw a mention of cold fusion.
Briefly, yeah.
Yeah.
Just clarifying why it's generally dismissed by physicists, the immense electromagnetic repulsion between nuclei, the Coulomb barrier. Menion-catalyzed fusion was mentioned as theoretically possible, but practically very, very difficult.
So, wrapping up this fusion story, a potentially significant theoretical and computational step forward for Stellarators, tackling a key confinement problem.
Exactly. It removed one particular roadblock, potentially making Stellarators a more viable path forward. But the overall road to commercial fusion power remains long and challenging, no doubt about it.
Wow. Okay, so that covers quite a range, doesn't it? From the data leaking from our phones to the intricacies of fusion reactors and the design of our cities. All from one day on Hacker News, May 12th, 2025.
It really does show the sheer breadth of topics that bubble up. And remember, we've just skimmed the surface here. The original articles, and especially the discussions on HN itself, often go much, much deeper.
Absolutely worth checking out if any of these sparked your interest.
Definitely.
So maybe a final thought to leave you with. As we see technology push boundaries in so many areas, AI understanding language, fusion energy getting closer, even the apps we use becoming more integrated into our lives. How do we keep up? How do we balance that excitement for innovation with the critical thinking needed about security, about ethics, about the real-world impact, both good and bad?
That feels like the thread connecting a lot of today's stories, doesn't it? From the responsibility of app developers to the grand challenges of energy and the way we build our world.
Something to ponder. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive on the HN Pod.
See you next time.